This recording is a production of Faith Builders Educational Programs. This presentation was recorded at Teachers Week 2015, held at Faith Builders on August 4 through 7.
I told you yesterday about the way that a child has an imagination that can be captured, it can be arrested and caused to grow. And if we can take a child and ignite that, we can cause them to learn more readily, and we can cause them to have a greater capacity for learning awakened within themselves. One example here, let's take a look at this area of nothingness in space. What's within nothingness? What I have here for you now to see is that the region of our sky that contains the Hubble Ultra Deep Field photograph, or the area that photograph came from. You can't see it very good right now because of all the lights, the ambient light on the screen. So could we have a volunteer to turn the lights off again like we did yesterday? Thank you for that. Just until I get finished with this slide here and the next picture. Here we have the Hubble Ultra Deep Field photograph area. If you look at the center of this image, you see there's not a lot of things to see. There's actually nothingness, especially right here within this triangle of stars. Astronomers wanted to see what empty space looks like. Of course, we know that space is full of empty space. Later on, I'll tell you how that there's an analogy that we could use saying that if the sun were the size of a grapefruit, the nearest star would be 2,000 miles away. So you see how much empty space there is in space, and we're actually living in a highly populated galaxy. So what does empty space look like? This is what astronomers wanted to know, so they took their new favorite instrument, the Hubble Space Telescope, and they pointed it at the center of this image that you see here. They opened the shutter on the camera inside this telescope for numerous exposures. These exposures all added up to about 11.3 days of total exposure time. They were looking so far out across the universe at such a tiny area in the sky that they had to leave the shutter open that long. Now, the lens on this camera is no mean lens, no simple, small, cheap China lens, if I can say that without being negative about the country over there. That's not what I mean. But this lens here has a mirror. It works on a mirror instead of just a refracting lens in the front, but there's a mirror that reflects light to a focal point, and it's close to 9 feet in diameter. So we're collecting light from a 9-foot cross-section of space, funneling it down to a single sensor, yet it takes an 11.3-day exposure to get what I'm about to show you here. And it was called the Hubble Ultra Deep Field photograph, taken from the center of this image in this tiny area that's about to pop out here. And you'll see that we actually see stars in this area. Not only stars, but with the exception of these three points of light, basically every one of the other dots, smudges, and speckles of light are not single stars, but are entire galaxies of millions and billions of stars. Now, this here is amazing in itself. But if we would take this picture apart and count the galaxies in it, we would come up to a number of nearly 10,000 galaxies, which is what astronomers have done. They've dissected this photograph. They've zoomed in on it. They found almost 10,000 galaxies on this one image. The amazing thing about it is the amount of area that it covers in space. If we were to go outside at night, pick up a grain of sand, and hold it at arm's length, it would completely blot out this entire area of sky. So if there's this many galaxies in such a small area of space, how much more is there in the universe all around us that we'll never discover, we'll never see? We can never photograph our entire sky in this manner because astronomers tell us it would take 1 million years of continuous observing to be able to photograph the entire sky like this. So we don't know what all God has created. It's impossible for us to even see. Now, this is with a telescope that's got a mirror 9 foot in diameter. Now, here on the Earth these days, we have telescopes that are 30 feet in diameter. Some are in the works that are over 100 feet in diameter, about the size of this gym, or even larger. It's amazing. So you see the potential for us to see so much farther into the universe yet, and see what God has made and what God has done, and pick up the light from so many other faint galaxies. Now, looking at this here, being the size of a grain of sand held at arm's length, that would be about the same size as the glare of light coming from a bright star in the night sky. So if you could, for me, the next time you go out and you look up and you see one of those bright stars, just imagine that behind every one of those bright stars is potentially an entire field of about 10,000 galaxies in this, just like this area of space here. It was just a nondescript empty area. If you were to look at it with your naked eye, it would be nothing there, nothing to see. But dig deep, and there it is. The scriptures say in Psalm, I'm not sure what the reference is, but it says, "Oh, magnify the Lord with me and let us exalt his name together." When we magnify the heavens, we magnify the Lord, and it causes us to want to exalt his name. All right, we can have the lights again, please. And moving on here, we'll get to Job 38:31, where we left off yesterday. "Canst thou bind the sweet influences of Pleiades?" Pleiades here is a star cluster that you see on the screen right now. This was imaged through long exposure photography. That's why we can see the nebulosity around it. But God was revealing something to Job here. Who knows exactly what he was talking about when he was referring to the sweet influences. Maybe it was the beauty that you can see there in the cluster. But he said something about binding this cluster. Was he just using filler words? Or does God do things like that? Well, as we looked at this cluster with modern equipment, astronomers, they found a few things about it. Let's see here. Isabel Lewis of the United States Naval Observatory has said this right here. "Astronomers have identified 250 stars as actual members of this group, all sharing in a common motion and drifting through space in the same direction." Elsewhere, Lewis speaks of them as journeying onward together through the immensity of space. From the Lick Observatory came this statement of Dr. Robert J. Trumpler. "Over 25,000 individual measures of the Pleiades stars are now available, and their study led to the important discovery that the whole cluster is moving in a southeasterly direction. The Pleiades stars may thus be compared to a swarm of birds flying together to a distant goal. This leaves no doubt that the Pleiades are not a temporary or accidental agglomeration of stars, but a system in which the stars are bound together by a close kinship. Canst thou bind the sweet influences of Pleiades?" So once again here, just looking at God's creation in a little more detail adds a little more depth to the scriptures, and shows how that God, in his word, he uses language that isn't just always filler words, or he uses words that aren't just filler words at times, but actually reveal important truths about the way the world works around us and the way that we should live our lives. All right, the next part of that same verse, we have the second question. Can you loose the bands of Orion? Now, I'm sure you're probably already guessing what's happening here. Orion's bands are being loosened. Before I get into that, I want to give you just a bit of a background of what God was doing with Job here, because since I didn't get that finished yesterday. But Job was he was sick, and he had been sick for a while. He was getting discouraged. His friends weren't any help for him. And so he was showing Job his sufficiency to take care of all of Job's problems. One of the things that, or actually, if you read through Job chapter 38, you find lots of examples that God was using to show Job how that he himself was much greater than anything that Job could imagine. He had the entire creation under control. And in the examples that he used before verse 31, most of them were fairly clear that God was doing whatever he was asking Job if Job could do. And of course, he turned to astronomy here to try to show Job his power. And in this verse here, verse 31, the last part of it, he says, can you loose the bands of Orion? And here we have the constellation Orion on the screen now. I'll put up the line so you can see the figure better. This is the lower part of Orion's body. These are the three bright stars of his belt. The upper stars here are his shoulders. This is his head. This is the supergiant star Betelgeuse we talked about earlier. Now, if you see this figure here, it somewhat looks like the constellation Orion. Some people can't really, it looks like Orion the Hunter. Some people can't really make out a resemblance, but it looks fairly straightforward to me, even though it's not a perfect rendition of a hunter. But in this area right here, the belt star area, there's lots of additional stars that we can see through long exposure photography. We'll zoom in on it. You can see these three stars. And we also see lots of other stars. We see additional nebulosity over here. This is the Horsehead Nebula kicked on its side. There's lots of interesting things to see. Astronomers have noticed that these three stars are actually slowly moving apart from each other. So in effect, God is loosening the bands of Orion, just like he insinuated when he asked Job. All right, now for the big shrink. And this may be hazardous for the health of your pride. It works that way for me. Realizing when we see how large this universe is and our seemingly insignificant part of it makes us understand that we are very small in this sight. Excuse me, I got one more thing to show you here. Down here in Orion's sword, hanging from his belt, is a pink spot right there. There's a pink spot in the center of the sword. We'll take a closer look at that, and you can see what's actually there. If you get a chance to look at the sword of Orion through binoculars, please take it, because this is what you'll see. Now, you won't see it in this type of a splendor, this type of beauty. You won't see all this color or this amount of detail, because this was taken by the Hubble Space Telescope, which, of course, has a giant lens on it. But if you look at it through binoculars, you should be able to see a haze. It should look like a slightly milky area of space. This is called the Orion Nebula, another masterpiece of God's creation. Seek him that maketh the seven stars and Orion. The Lord is his name. This is from Amos 5:8. So he's directing us to seek him when we've noticed the Pleiades and Orion that we've just looked at just now. All right, we're going to shrink the Earth down to the size of a quarter, which is 1 inch across here, to be able to a little better comprehend the size of the things in the universe around us. So we get it down to a little more manageable state. This quarter right here will be transformed into the Earth. And you can see it there, the Earth about the size of a quarter now. So we'll move on from this as a basis for our analogy. At this scale, the planet Uranus would be about 4 inches across, the size of a softball. As you see here, Uranus is one of the bigger planets, but it's not the biggest. Jupiter is the biggest planet in our solar system. And in our analogy, it would be about 11 inches across, as you see here, about the size of a basketball. The next step will be taking us on to the sun. And here we have the sun, about 9 feet across. It's about 9 feet high. It would put it up above the eaves of this house that we have here for comparison. And of course, there's other stars that are bigger than the sun. The brightest actual star in our night sky, as viewed from the Earth here, is called Sirius. And that one shows up over here on the right. It would be about 17 feet high in comparison to the sun. Now, this star isn't necessarily so much brighter than the others because it's bigger than the others. It's simply because it's so much closer than most of the stars. But there's other stars that are even bigger than Sirius, of course, like we heard, like we covered yesterday. One of those was Arcturus, 234 feet in diameter. And you see how it would be about the height of a cellular communications tower there. Moving on, we'll come to Rigel. This star would be about 700 feet high, about two times the height of the Statue of Liberty. And you see lots of people down here for a comparison. And you see how much bigger this star is now. Remember, this is at the proper scale with a quarter-sized Earth. The next step will be to the supergiant star Betelgeuse, and we're going to stay here in New York City, drop him in over the historic Twin Towers. We'll pretend they're still there, and we'll drop Betelgeuse in here. It will be 10,500 feet high, about seven times higher than the Twin Towers that were in New York City. This is just a bit overwhelming for me, looking at this star, realizing that the Earth would be like a quarter laying on the sidewalk there beneath those skyscrapers. And Betelgeuse is incomprehensibly larger than anything we could imagine. Now we've got one last step here, going to a subcategory of supergiants. These are called hypergiants again. This star that I'll talk about next and last is VY Canis Majoris. It would be 3 miles long, about four times the span of the Golden Gate Bridge, or the length of the bridge there. So you see that we have another enormous star, and this is a picture of the creative power of God. How can God create such enormous spheres, thermonuclear furnaces that are pouring out copious amounts of light, heat, and energy, and all sorts of exotic radiation like ultraviolet rays and gamma rays, X-rays, infrared waves, and lots of optical light, of course, too, microwaves. And we can take telescopes and we can isolate each one of these segments of the spectrum, and we can learn additional things about the stars. There's a wealth of information to be learned about the stars simply by looking at the light that's coming from them. I'll have something more on the energy that God must have released in order to create the universe around us later on, maybe tomorrow morning or the next morning, I'm not sure. But let's look at what the scriptures have to say about the creation of these stars. Psalm 33:6, "By the word of the Lord were the heavens made, and all the host of them by the breath of his mouth." So God just breathes stars out? Is that how he does? I don't know how God did it, but on day four of creation, did he just speak the word and from the breath of his mouth there appeared thousands and millions and trillions of stars filling galaxies that are filled with all types of other things like comets and asteroids and black holes, quasars, magnetars, and gamma ray bursts, supernova explosions, and meteoroids and asteroids, all sorts of things all through the universe. Each one of them exhibiting a great deal of energy output, at least the stellar objects, incomprehensible sizes, and God just spoke them into existence. It's almost as if there were it's giving us a word picture as God just speaking the stars out from himself, and we could see a cloud of stars coming from that. Of course, I'm not saying that's what happened. I don't believe it actually appeared that way, but this photograph here could almost be a word picture for that, for this reference here, this scripture. The breath of his mouth, it looks like a vapor cloud coming from someone's mouth. "To whom then will you liken God, or what likeness will you compare unto him?" Isaiah 40:18. So these stars here are the largest, most powerful natural objects that we know of, but yet if they're just like a vapor droplet from in comparison to God, how much greater is he than these things? This is a picture of an actual star, the nearest star to us, our sun. You can see how there's lots of dynamic activity on the star here, and we'll take it and we'll put it into motion here. If I can get this to work, here we go. You can see this activity on the sun. There's magnetic filaments of plasma that are being pulled out of the sun and are being dragged back down into the surface of the sun again and plunged below that surface there. What's happening is that there are magnetic field lines circling around the sun, through the sun. The sun is a giant magnet, but the sun also rotates at a speed at the equator that's different from the speed that's at the polar regions. The rotation speed at the equator is actually greater in a 24-hour period or a 30-hour period than the one at the polar regions. So the sun is, the center is moving around faster, of course, because it's got a longer way to go, but it takes more rotations as well. So because of that, these magnetic field lines are getting twisted up within the sun. And over a period of the 11-year cycle of the sun, these field lines get twisted up so tremendously bad that they actually start to pop out of the sun. And when they pop out of the sun like this, they'll drag solar particles with them and cause them to be driven back down into the surface again. When that happens, we're left with a sunspot. So wherever you see these bright areas in this exposure, there's actually a sunspot there that when we look at it in visible wavelengths, we see a dark area. But when we look at it in the hydrogen alpha wavelengths like this here, or let me see, this, I think this may be something a different wavelength than that, well, then we actually see brightness, additional brightness there. So these stars, as you see here, they're dynamic, they're very active, they're powerful. But to us, they look like they're just flickering candles ready to be extinguished in the night sky by a blast of air. They look so fragile up there. But this, that belies their true nature, one of enormous powerhouses of energy. Why do the stars twinkle and appear so fragile like they are? One reason, of course, is because they're so far away, so they're tiny. But the reason they actually twinkle and flicker like they do is because there is lots of atmospheric turbulence between us and the stars. Right here you see it looks like the stars are twinkling there. And you see how they jump around a little. That's kind of what you see in the night sky. And it, if you've noticed before, the lower you look toward the horizon, the more they seem to twinkle. The ones straight above us don't seem to twinkle quite as much. The reason for that is we're looking through much more atmosphere when we're looking out this direction than we are when we look straight up. So these stars, as their tiny profile is coming to us through the atmosphere, if there's just a bit of turbulence in the air, that turbulence in the air can shift that light ray off to the side and it might miss our eye, or the star could be its apparent position could be changed just a little. So for that reason, it appears to jump around and change in brightness. Now we'll zoom in on this, and you can see what it looks like zoomed in and put into slow motion, 10 times slower than actual speed. You can see the process that's actually happening there. Zoom in one more time, and you can see what's happening in this magnified view of a twinkling star. It's all because of the atmosphere distorting the view. That's why the Hubble Space Telescope is so valuable, because we have it up above the atmosphere and we don't have this distorting effect of the air. It's not because the scope is closer to the stars. That's a misconception that some have, but simply because it's above our atmosphere, only about 300 miles above us. Next, we'll look at the size of the universe. Looking at the distance from the Earth to the Moon, we have about 238,000 miles from the Earth to the Moon, and it would take about 20 days to fly there on an airliner moving at about 600 miles per hour. So the Moon is relatively close to us, the nearest celestial neighbor that we have. Then we go on to the Sun, which is about 92,960,000 miles away. It would take 17 years to fly there at about 600 miles per hour. The next step will be Pluto, which is a dwarf planet that's gotten a little more attention recently. This planet here would be, dwarf planet would be about 3.7 billion miles away. It would take 700 years to fly there at about 600 miles per hour. And traveling at 65 miles per hour, it would take 6,500 years to reach Pluto, which is 40 times farther from the Sun than the Earth is. So you see, we've taken a giant leap just to get out to the edge of our solar system. The next step will be the nearest star, which is called Proxima Centauri. This star is 4.2 light years away from us, and would convert to 24,689,719,000,000 miles. It's about 6,800 times farther from us than Pluto, a 4.7 million year flight. So to leave the planets and get to the stars, we have to go about almost 7,000 times farther than the furthest than Pluto. So we have a great distance to cover just to get to the stars. Now, you see I've switched to light years here, 4.2 light years. I'd like to give you an explanation for that because we'll have to use this as we go on through the presentation later on. The reason for that is because we're dealing with huge distances. And so because of this, astronomers use other units of measurement such as astronomical units, parsecs, megaparsecs, and kiloparsecs, and they use light years. We have to sympathize with them because they are dealing with big or vast expanses through space. We can hardly understand these units of measurement, but we understand it's important to use it because the distances are so large. It's for the same reason that I wouldn't say that I had to drive 762,000 inches to get to the hardware store yesterday afternoon. It just doesn't make sense. All right, so let's look at a light year. It's the distance that light travels in 1 year. Light travels at 186,000 miles per second. And if we let that light go for one year, we get up to about 5.88 trillion miles, or 6 trillion miles to be precise. So one light year is about 6 trillion miles long. Now, if you look at these two units of measurement, you see that 186,000 miles per second probably sounds faster to you than 6 trillion miles per year. It does to me. I just assume that it does to you as well, because I think the reason for that is because this number is within my realm of crunchability. I can crunch this number. The bottom number, 6 trillion, is just huge. It's gargantuan. It's gigantic. Ryan Hoover yesterday, he was giving us some good analogies to explain to us some of these numbers in his Creation Wonders class. Extremely, very interesting there. But let's try to comprehend these numbers, because in order for us to truly understand and appreciate the distances across our universe, we're going to have to understand and appreciate these numbers as well, as good as possible. So what I'll do is I'll start out with a familiar object here, at least maybe to some of you out there. This is a $100 bill, and we all know the size of a $100 bill, less than a millimeter thick. But what we'll do is we'll add to this $100 until we get to $1 trillion. Now, a light year is 6 trillion miles long, but we're going to slice it into six sections and pick out one of those and see how big 1 trillion is in $100 bills. So we'll get to $1 trillion here in just a minute. On the way, we'll stop at $10,000. You see there's a stack about the size, or about like a card deck here, or an inch high. Moving on to $1 million, we have a briefcase-sized stack of cash at the man's feet. The next step is $100 million, and this is an accurate rendition of what $100 million would look like. We would need a pallet to hold all this cash. Keep in mind as I'm going through this that these are not made up of ones, fives, tens, or twenties, but we actually have $100 bills here to make up this stack. The next step is $1 billion, and we need 10 pallets to hold this much cash. The next and last step will be $1 trillion, and here you go. This entire field needed to contain this much money. And if you have good eyesight, you can see our midget over here for comparison. And looking closely across this stack, you see there's a line running through there. That's because the pallets are actually double stacked. So they're stacked too high, and we need this gigantic area to hold $1 trillion. Now, this isn't 1 trillion bills. This is $1 trillion represented by $100 bills. If this were 1 trillion pieces of paper, the little bills that we have in U.S. currency, if it were 1 trillion of those, the stack would be 100 times bigger. Couldn't fit in this slide here. So, again, $1 trillion is enormous. Now, in case this doesn't do justice to it, and I know it doesn't, we'll give you one more little illustration. The significance of large numbers is shown by looking at them on a simple graphical scale here. The distance from 1 to 1 billion is illustrated here. Now, we understand how there's number groups. We go from the hundreds to the thousands, then we have the millions, then the billions, trillions, quadrillions, on out like that. Let's look at the location of 1 million within this scale. We have 100s, 1,000s, then 1 millions. But it shouldn't be this close to 1 billion. It should actually be, most of the time we think it's probably about halfway between 1 and a billion. Maybe, you know, we know 1 billion is much bigger than 1 million, so maybe a little closer to 1 here. The actual location on this scale for 1 million would be right here, 1/10 of the way to the first dot after we leave 1. That's home for 1 million. He has to stay there. He doesn't belong out here. He's not big enough for that. So we have this entire distance to cover before we get to 1 billion. Now, if we take a scale on the distance from 1 to 1 trillion, we have basically the same effect. 1 billion here has to squeeze in somewhere between 1 and a trillion. The proper location for it is 1/10 of the way after we leave, to the first dot after we leave 1 there. And that means that the entire top scale here is squeezed into the tiny space between 1 and a billion, and we have all this distance to cover before we get to 1 trillion. So 1 light year, in retrospect, is 6 trillion miles long. The Milky Way galaxy is what we'll step out into next. This here is a conglomeration of stars. Stars are arranged in groups like this called galaxy. Our home galaxy is called the Milky Way because of the appearance that it takes as it stretches from one horizon to the other, a milky band of light. The sun is 2/3 of the way out from the center of the galaxy, and within this circle is where the sun is and all the planets, but not just the sun and the planets, but actually all the stars that we see in the night sky without the help of binoculars or telescope. When we look at individual stars, we're only looking at a small part of our home galaxy. The solar system there at the end of the arrow is so small that we can't see it at this scale. We would have to use a microscope to be able to see it at this scale here. In fact, it's so small that let's just imagine that we were to zoom this into the size of a quarter, which I don't have with me right now, but if we were to take this solar system at the end of the arrow and blow it up to the size of a quarter, which would be smaller than the arrowhead here, but just get it to the size of a quarter where we can actually see it, we would have to make the Milky Way galaxy correspondingly larger to be at the proper scale with the quarter-sized solar system. At that rate, the Milky Way galaxy would need to be 2,000 miles from one end to the other to be at the proper scale with a quarter-sized solar system. So it would just barely fit in the United States here. Of course, it wouldn't fit from north to south, but it would from east to west. The Milky Way galaxy is estimated to be about 100,000 light years across, and it contains over 100 billion stars. Astronomers tell us that for every one of these stars in our galaxy, we can find another galaxy somewhere else in the universe with millions and billions more stars. So these galaxies in themselves are amazing. There are other galaxies all around us. One of them is called the Andromeda Galaxy, and it's basically our next door neighbor, the nearest major galaxy to us. It's 2.4 million light years away, or 14 quintillion, 108 quadrillion, 411 trillion, 189 billion, 256 million miles. And once again, that's why astronomers use light years. Now, this here is basically our next door neighbor, but we're at distances like this. Can we comprehend the distance to this galaxy? Of course not. But we can try. And one way we can do it is try to follow along with a light beam moving at 186,000 miles per second. Let's imagine that the roof is gone. I shine this laser and the beam has left now. It's moving at close to 200,000 miles every second, just blitzing through space, vaporizing everything in its path. And as it goes, and now it's been about 6, 7, 8 seconds, so we're already over 1 million miles into space. And by now, it's probably at a distance farther than most of us will travel in our lifetime. But let's imagine where that light would be at the end of Teacher Week. What about at the end of this month? What about next year, this time, on August the 6th, 5th, whatever we have today? Where would that light be? If you can imagine that distance out in front of you, a segment that long, and if you can grasp that, well, let's take the next step. If not, just stay where you're at. But we could take 2.4 million more sections and line them up end to end, and we would eventually get to our neighbor here, the Andromeda Galaxy. Now, it's not the closest galaxy of any type to us. There are some dwarf irregular galaxies that are a little, that are closer than the Andromeda Galaxy, such as the, they're actually just called clouds in their common names, though, like the Large Magellanic Cloud and the Small Magellanic Cloud. Those are two of those smaller galaxies that are closer to us. All right, as we look in our telescopes, we see galaxies much farther away than the Andromeda Galaxy, even 5,000 times farther out across space. Here's the analogy that I referred to earlier. If the sun were a large grapefruit here, the Earth would be smaller than the head of a pin and 50 feet from the grapefruit sun. At this scale, Proxima Centauri, which is the nearest star, would be about the size of a cherry over 2,000 miles away. So this shows us the size of the Earth in comparison to these other things as well. The Earth would be a pinhead 50 feet from the grapefruit sun, and the nearest star would be about 2,000 miles away. And once again, if you remember that artist rendering I had of the galaxy, you noticed how that we're in a very highly populated region of space. There's lots of stars all around us, but yet there's so much empty space that the nearest star would still be 2,000 miles away in this analogy. Isaiah 40 verse 12 says, "Who hath meted out heaven with the span?" God in some way is much greater than anything He's created. This is not telling us that God has a physical size. God doesn't have a physical body as such. He's a spirit. We don't know exactly what God is composed of other than His goodness and His light. But we know that. So it's not telling us God has a physical size that He has a hand that He just hovers over His universe as if He were protecting it. But we know that God is omnipresent. He completely encompasses His universe, and it's just a small thing to Him. How do we know these stars are so far away from us? I'll have to speed up here, unfortunately, because we're getting into the technical section here. But let's just, a lot of people look at these distances and they say, or think, yeah, right, how do they know they're so far out there? Have they been there? No, of course we can't get there. But we can look and we can study, and with the tools and the intellect that God has given us, we can determine. So the most reliable method is by looking at stellar parallax. As the Earth goes around the sun in its orbit once a year, we traverse across almost 200 million miles of space from one side of the orbit to the other. So when we do this, stars that are nearby to us appear to shift in their position in the night sky slightly. Now, this is an exaggerated effect here, but you see when we're over here in the springtime and we look at star A, we're looking at a different angle than what we are looking at it when we're over here in the fall and looking at the same star. So we can look at, we can take these angles, and through simple mathematics, trigonometry, we can calculate these angles and we can get the distance to this star through triangulation. A star that's farther away from us, like this star up here, will have a steeper angle to our triangle, but a star that's closer to us will have a more shallow angle. Now, even though we move across almost 200 million miles of space from one side of our orbit to the other, there are some stars that are so high above us that they don't appear to shift in position at all. And in fact, most of the stars out beyond our view fall into that category. So we have to use other methods to determine the distance. One of them is by looking at the redshift of starlight. The redshift interpretation shows that if a star is close to us, we will find the absorption line within the spectrum closer to the blue end. If a star is farther away from us, it'll be closer to the red end. Starlight has these little absorption lines in them. If we take a prism and set it in the path of starlight, we can spread that starlight out and we see all the different wavelengths of light. But there are gaps in there. These gaps correspond to the elements that are in the star. And by that, we can tell what the star is actually made of, mostly hydrogen and helium, things like that. But sometimes those, and those absorption lines will always be at a certain part of the spectrum. That's the way it works. But sometimes all of those absorption lines will be skewed toward the red end, and that means that the star is moving away from us. And since the universe is expanding at a uniform rate, we know that as a rule of thumb, the faster a star moves from us, the farther away it is from us as well. Here is another illustration of it. If a star is moving towards us, the light rays will be compressed, and you will have the absorption lines shifted toward the blue end of the spectrum. If it's moving away from us, the light rays will be stretched, and you'll have absorption lines shifted toward the red end of the spectrum, like you see here. Now, since, like I said earlier, the expansion of the universe makes so that star, if let's imagine that we are star B and we have star A here close to us, and star C is out farther away from us. Now let's expand this little universe here, and we see how the distance between B and C is growing faster than the distance between B and A. We'll reverse this and go at it again, and you can see how there's not a lot of space increasing here between these two, but much more there. So, just gives you an illustration of how that works. Is there evidence for this actual red shift of, or blue shift based on whether it's coming toward us or moving away from us? There actually is. This is a picture of the spectrum coming from Jupiter. Now, if you look at it here, these lines are actually tilted. Most of them are. The ones that correspond to the absorption lines are actually tilted. The reason for that is when astronomers took this picture of Jupiter, this section of Jupiter, which right here just have a thin section, but it encompassed both the regions that were approaching us and receding away from us. The regions that were approaching us correspond to the right side of this image, and you see how that all these lines are drugged toward the blue end of the spectrum. And I've got a battery dying in this remote. I don't know if someone could get me a different one or some batteries. Thank you for that. So what I'll do here is I'll actually just take this colorful spectrum and place it. I'll impose it onto this region here, and it's easier to see. So on this side of Jupiter, on the right side where it's approaching to us, we have absorption lines that are tilted up towards the blue end. Thank you for that. But on the other side, you see the opposite effect there. Let's see if this works for us. Good. And so it's a good example of how this red shift and blue shift works. And of course, there are other methods too. There's actually about 10 different methods that astronomers use to determine the distance to the stars. All right. If you give me just a minute, I will select what I want to show you yet. We'll skip the rest. We're out of time here. Just a few concluding thoughts. Well, let's hit this first. In case you think that we're insignificant in God's creation, I want you to just give you this quick little illustration of how that man is actually the centerpiece of God's creation. As far as we can tell, we are about in the center of the magnitudes of scale going from the largest structures to the smallest. And so even though there's this enormous universe surrounding us, we don't have to feel insignificant. But we're actually right at the heart of the things that God has made. And we will, let's summarize it with this here. The universe reveals God's attributes. And because God is strong, His creation shows power. Because God is great, His creation is vast. Because God is beautiful, His creation reflects glory. And because God is love, His creation includes you.
This recording and many others are available through Christian Learning Resource, the campus bookstore at Faith Builders. Order online at www.christianlearning.org or call 877-222-4769.